Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And today's show brought to you by Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. You know what I say, always go with the best. Sunbury Motors fits that category right across the board. Time now for our play-by-play call today. Well, I know Matty Ice is here now, fresh after going over to Bucknell.
Yes, that is correct.
Elio, diehard Mets fan, picked this one.
I figured, I knew who was right before me once I saw this play-by-play left for me.
All right, go ahead. Let's go. Let's endure.
Tie game,
seconds.
Pitch.
Swing and a drive to left. That one's going to go to home run, Pete Alonso, and the Mets take the lead. For Big Pete, and City Field is making as much noise as we've heard in a long time.
Chris Elio with the call from his living room last night as Pete Alonso knocks out his 35th homer of the year, and the Mets are over 500.
Wow. Hey. You know, it was about this time in 1969, 50 years ago, that the Miracle Mets reached 500 in August, and yet they went on to win the World Series. Tom Seaver, Jerry Kuzman,
Gary Gentry, and Nolan Ryan.
Hot Rod Caneal, Marvelous Marv Throneberry, etc.
Gone.
Yes.
They picked up Don Clendenin in a trade from the Pirates.
Yes.
All right, they had Ed Charles, Cleon Jones, Tommy Agee, Ron Swoboda, Ed Cranepool, Jerry Grody.
Grody the catcher, Craney at first.
Yeah.
Man, you and I love those Miracle Mets.
Yeah. They made some plays. All right, they made a lot of plays.
Yeah.
We're going to talk Pro Football Focus in the final half hour. In fact, it's going to be a weekly segment.
Oh, excellent.
We've hooked in with Pro Football Focus to break things down. In fact, you know, I may have a couple of, like, Bucknell breakdowns, and what I'll do is, if I get them, Matty, I'll send them to you, because I figured, you know, because Doug's got to call the play.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, we might have a future Bucknell Bison in the NFL. There was a Redskin scout today at Bucknell practice for Alex Peachin.
There you go. Very good.
And he's in what position?
Punter.
The punter.
Oh, the punter. Yes.
He's the punter.
Well, the high altitude over at Christy Mathewson Stadium, I think, disguises that.
The kid's got a leg, though.
Yeah, he does.
I think he averaged like 65 yards a punt last year. It was something ridiculous like that. It was huge for Bucknell for a struggling offense.
Yes, that's right.
But I figure if I give you the numbers, because Doug's got to call the plays.
That's right. I'll go right with him.
Right.
We got it.
Right. The other guy. The only numbers he cares about are sales numbers.
I just go by what I see.
He's just become changed. It's amazing how one announcement changes a man.
The man is the interim general manager or whatever title.
Interim director of sales and finance.
Oh, okay. Is that what it is?
That is correct.
He asked me to address him as El Jefe. I don't know why.
I wasn't given that memo yet.
Yeah.
I think that was just personal.
Yeah.
I went back and asked him if he wanted coffee. He said yes. I said, well, good. Go get it.
Exactly.
All right.
There we go.
If we asked him to get coffee, he would for us. Neil Kulong, USA Today. Hello, Neil.
It's great to be here as always. Thanks for having me.
All right. The stoic, staid, quiet Steeler camp continues. Has it been as boring as it seems?
Yeah, I mean, we knew this was coming. I think this is the obvious reaction to what it's been over the last, I don't want to say the last couple of years, maybe 2 years. And most of it centers around Le'Veon Bell. Without that, you don't have the high level of drama. But with this, they're going out of their way, I think, to to stay away from anything at all, which I'm not necessarily sure was the problem to begin with. I think it's the fact that your star running back wasn't in training camp 2 years in a row. That might have been more the storyline. People want to blame entrances and things like that. But I guess last year, I mean, you know, if there was any other drama provided, it was by the fact that Antonio Brown didn't practice, and that was due to injury. And sounds like he's got kind of the same thing going on now in Oakland. So I'm not sure exactly what they're avoiding or what they really need to drum up. A lot of those issues were, you know, kind of time specific. And for where they are as a team right now, I don't think we know enough about them to really say they're going to do this, they're going to do that. The storyline really is the absence of certainly one player, the collective absence of two players over the last 2 years. And we're going to add in the fact that nobody's going to talk about it, as if that's, you know, anything that we shouldn't have expected. If it's dull, that's fine. I don't think it's necessarily conducive to them winning or losing games. But there's not a whole lot of storylines. I don't think there are a whole lot of stories really to tell for what we have right now. They want it this way, but their play on the field is going to do the talking for them. And we'll see what that's going to be. I really don't know. There are a lot of things up in the air right now, and they're not actively providing any fodder for anybody to speculate on anything. So a little bit different than perhaps what we're used to,
yeah.
But not really surprising either.
All right. In the first preseason game, how much work does the first unit get? A series, two?
I think... knowing them, what they'll typically do is they'll play a series or two, depending on how it goes. If they get the work in that they want, if there are a certain amount of reps that they get to run, they'll pull individuals at any one time. You're going to see certain guys playing a little bit longer than other guys, and a lot of that might, there are injuries and things like that that play into it. It's not so much strategy as it is, you know, they're obligated to field a team of some kind. So they're you know, you can count on there being five offensive linemen. But if you need another guard, maybe DeCastro stays in there for another series. A lot of it really just kind of depends on what the situation is going to be. But certainly, and this has been the case with the team for a while now, there are not a whole lot of first-team positions up for grabs. I don't think there are a whole lot of competitions that are out there at the starter level. Really, with this team, it's with the backups. And I think with that, I think it's going to be interesting to see what they do at right tackle. There's a position to be had there between two guys who have been around for a bit, and we've gotten a little bit of look of both Matt Filer and Chucks to see which one of them was going to get the starting job. But I think that's something that it really only comes with first team work, and we're not going to see either one of them playing with, you know, DeCastro to their left all that much. So I don't know how much we're really going to glean from a preseason game for a position battle like that. But there's also the rookies, too. I enjoy seeing the rookie running backs get in there, get a look of what they can do, because those are the guys on the field that probably see the most legitimate work than any other position will. I've got my eye on Deontay Johnson. I'm really excited about him coming and what he's going to be able to do for the Steelers this year. I think he's going to be a solid contributor, and he could be a guy that gets a lot of looks in the preseason. You know, knowing Mike Tomlin, the rookies play pretty much every snap. So getting those guys out there for, getting them reps and giving them a chance to show what they can get, that's really what we're looking at more than anything. The first team in and of itself, I think, is kind of a wash. We're not going to get much from them anyway.
What is it about Johnson that does excite you?
I really liked him in terms of his intelligence on the field. He seemed to be a very, very smart route runner, not just a good route runner, but he knew where to go. He had a good read on defenses. He was in the right spot a lot, and I say that because the majority of his catches are uncontested. There weren't people around him, and that isn't to, you know, at a superficial level, that's a knock on the competition that he's playing. But for him, if he's going up against his own defense, he knows exactly where to go against that zone to get himself open. That's a very valuable trait. And this isn't, you know, a high-level guy. I don't expect him to get 160 targets or anything like that, but I think he's going to be a very reliable NFL receiver. The receivers the Steelers have brought in over the last 7-8 years fit sort of a similar mold. They're all a certain size. Their athleticism is at a certain level. I think Deontay Johnson fits in very well with that. But I think he was more of a polished route runner coming out of college and coming into the Steelers than pretty much any of the other ones were. I was really impressed with Emmanuel Sanders back in the day, but I think Johnson's at that level. I think he's a good athlete. He's a good functional athlete, and he's going to continue to grow and get stronger. So I think he's going to be a very, very solid player moving forward, and a lot of it is just because he has a higher baseline, I think, than a lot of the younger ones who have come in over the last couple seasons. Now, you know, a lot of people that say he compares favorably to Antonio Brown when Brown was coming out of college. I don't buy into that. Brown became AB when he was a pro, when he got that constant work in. We'll see if Johnson's putting in that level of work, if he's able to grow up to that level. But just knowing where he is when he started, I think he's got an advantage over, his historic peers in the last couple of years of Steelers receivers, who have all, made, pretty reasonable pros. They're not all high-level guys, but as far as being productive NFL players, a lot of them were, certainly when they were in Pittsburgh. So I am excited to see what he's learned, what they're having him do, where they're playing him. And from that, I think we can glean a little bit of what the offense is planning on doing this season.
All right, so let's get into this a little bit more. What to you is more valuable? Is it the preseason game to see something like that, or is it the practice?
I think...
And I'm talking about scrimmage against another team.
I think a scrimmage against another, a controlled scrimmage, when both teams have certain objectives that they're trying to accomplish, plus the heightened level of competition going up against somebody else who's also competing for a spot as part of a team and not just one particular unit on the field. I mean, the linebackers in camp are going to kind of bond together, as well as the defensive backs are, because they're banging against guys that are wearing the same helmets as them. When you put a different team across from you, I think everybody's game goes up, the stakes get a little bit higher, and you really start to kind of see that the true competitors and the true gamers out of the group of guys that you have out there. For me, I think that's bigger. I can hear Tomlin saying this in my ear too. What happens when the stadium lights come on is really what differentiates the practice squad guys versus the Sunday guys. You get a sense of that when they're able to compete against another team in a similar position to them. I'm talking about the low end guys who aren't even necessarily just playing to make to earn a spot on the Steelers, but to put good film down to show another team in case they need a job down the line. There's a level of hunger that comes from certain players, and you see them out there in the preseason. But for me, having seen both of them, I really like the inner squad scrimmage against somebody else. I like the idea of practicing against another team leading into that preseason game, because you get a much more full look at a player in very specific controlled situations, as opposed to you don't know exactly what's going to happen here in a regular preseason game. If you have a muff snap or something like that, it's not going to be just move it back first and 10, let's run it again. It's legitimately second and 13. That's going to change up your play calling a little bit. It forces a situation that perhaps doesn't allow a certain player to get the look that you'd like to see from them. Yeah, I think you get a little bit more in the controlled environment, and just for me, and maybe it's just having been closer to it, the intensity is a lot higher. They're not messing around when they're out there. You really see guys going after each other as hard as you think that they would in training camp, and it doesn't really translate as well during a preseason game. That just might be my opinion, my slanted view of it. But getting another team out there, there's a lot of benefit to that.
Yeah. So the Steelers will get into this thing and play Tampa Bay on Friday night. So they'll play Tampa Bay on Friday night at Heinz Field. It's not Roethlisberger, and I know I asked you about this before. If Josh Dobbs plays like he did last year in the preseason, is that enough to hold off Mason Rudolph if Rudolph's improved?
Well, here's the thing. What are we really talking about here? A position on a depth chart that coaches themselves will say is not necessarily the case.
Right.
When they're in the film room, they might have certain tasks based on where they are in the depth chart. What really matters here is who's going to go in and play if Ben Roethlisberger got hurt. Now, that, I think, is really up in the air. I'm not necessarily sure that's something that's solely decided on a couple reps during training camp. I think, unfortunately for Josh Dobbs, I think there is a certain level of investment that comes to that. Rudolph would be the guy that they would want to get snaps to. They took him higher, in my opinion. This is just me talking. I mean, they took Dobbs in the fourth round, which some say might have been a little bit of a stretch. I think that's the right spot for the Steelers' philosophy for a player that they probably viewed more as a long-term backup, an investment that they wanted to have for long-term for a backup position. Rudolph, in my opinion, slipped just due to circumstances into the third round. I don't think he was a legitimate third-round prospect. I think I could have seen him definitely in the second, maybe in the top half of the first, or the second half of the first round. I think the Steelers know that. And I think that if you were to say today one of them is going to be the future unquestioned starter of the Steelers, it's Rudolph. So for me, I would think that would be the guy that you would want, perhaps to throw in the fire if it's close between the second and the third guy. So whoever it is that would be named the backup, I think that's, largely ceremonial anyway. I think when Roethlisberger gets hurt, we're going to find out who the team really believes is their quarterback. And I'll be honest with you, if that were to happen today, I don't think it's going to be between those two. I think they're going to go look for a veteran to come in and lead the team. They certainly would sign one. I think they would sign one with the idea that that veteran could compete to start as well. So right now where they would sit on the depth chart for this season, I don't think matters nearly as much considering Roethlisberger is healthy. Whatever order they want to put him in, reward one versus the other for what they do during practice, during training camp, that's fine. But I don't think it ultimately will matter for when the backup position would be elevated into the starting role.
I think Charlie Batch could give him a series. Kind of just a
Bring him in.
Yeah,
Utah.
Yeah, I mean, why not? This is a business question. Heinz Field, in all likelihood, in a couple of years, will no longer be known as, quote, Heinz Field. Because that deal that they signed, which in the end turns out to be a pretty much a sweetheart deal compared to everybody else in the league, is going to expire, and Heinz probably is not going to renew with it. In the current business climate, especially in Pittsburgh, how wide open could the bidding be for the naming rights in that stadium?
It's funny that you bring that up. I was looking into that, not in wake of the news that we found out, but I was just curious what kind of deals teams get. They're all over the board. Even at the NFL level, the differences between like the highest and the lowest are crazy. It really kind of depends on where you are, what businesses are there, and I think, and this is just my unscientific opinion, the ego factor of it. If you've got somebody that's in control of a multi-billion-dollar company and they really want to see their brand on an NFL stadium, they'll pay for it.
Right.
So that bumps up the price considerably and compared to an area that doesn't want to be associated with a terrible team, with a controversial stadium or mascot nickname or whatever. I mean, there are so many different variables that go into it. I would imagine in a place like Pittsburgh, there's really only a couple companies that you could see bidding on it. Heinz probably wouldn't have been the first one I would have thought of today. But when Heinz Field was built, it certainly makes sense that a national brand like that that's associated with the city of Pittsburgh, that would make sense. But I would say this: the practice facility is sponsored by UPMC. That'd be my guess. That makes the most parallel sense. They already have a business relationship, even to the point where I would say this has been their plan for however long. They had a partnership with Heinz. When they eventually move in a different direction, because as far as I know, any stadium that's been around even for 6-7 years has had a switch of the name at some point. I would think UPMC would be the front runner. That's just me, but some of that comes from the fact that growing up in Minneapolis, Target Center is where the Timberwolves played.
That's right.
And then Target Field was built for the Twins, and Target wasn't considered to be a front runner for those naming rights. And the Twins even said part of it was we like the consistency. We want to be a Minneapolis, based team, and Target Field is right around the corner, or Target Center is right around the corner. So there was some consistency that we liked about that. Probably, code for they paid the most money. But I could see UPMC being the front runner, from a financial standpoint as well as a continuity standpoint. From a business end, I think that makes sense.
About the stadium itself, for example, the Arizona Diamondbacks are lobbying right now to get a new stadium there. Their stadium is 20, 21 years old. Henderson, Nevada, for example, has floated the idea that, hey, we could take the Diamondbacks if there's no... It seems like 20 years is the shelf life before those such demands are made. So, right now, with Heinz Field, what are they, you know, Heinz Field's what, 21 years old, 20 years old?
20, I think it's gone on 20,
2001, so it's like 18 years old, right?
Yeah.
18 years old? Okay. Where is that right now? Does it have any, quote, need for upgrading? Is it in good shape? Has it got five more years before they start thinking about something?
I think from what we've seen in the Steelers' actions recently, I know they had a little bit of a dispute over building seats behind the one end of the stadium. They wanted to do that for a while. They wanted to make them VIP level. There was some consternation with that locally, but it's the Steelers. They're not going to struggle real hard to get, you know, politically what they want to get out of whatever situation they're in. As far as the stadium itself goes, I'm of the belief that a football stadium is not so much of a backdrop to the game itself the way a baseball stadium is. It's not, you know, a kind of a pastime experience. Football, you're there to you know, ardently pay attention to what's going on. That's not really baseball so much. You need the sight lines in baseball. You really need an architectural, you know, marvel to bring people in to want to be a part of the total experience. The stadium experience in the NFL, in my opinion, it's not, they're all pretty bland. If you walk around most NFL stadiums, whatever age, they're all kind of the same. They're not
exactly.
There's not really a whole lot of innovation when it comes to an NFL stadium outside of the features that you put in. I get Jerry World. I understand the gigantic, you know, Jumbotron screen that they have. The newest stadium is always probably going to be the coolest, but the features that they're putting money into is more to maintain the surface, locker rooms for an effort to bring in free agents, multi-purpose use, like Minneapolis had to put into U.S. Bank Field there just to get the thing built. They had to make it more or less a community venue. Those types of things go more into it, I think, than just this is a really cool place to watch a game. You know, I don't think fans really care so much about the stadium, and I say that with all due respect to anybody from San Diego who listens in. I went to that stadium. That was a completely different world.
Yes,
that place should have been condemned. I mean,
I've been there. Yeah,
so
I've been there.
Like what you're talking, I think in this century is more what you mean. The ones that have been built now, they're going to have a certain appeal to watching the game. But in the end, it's going to be multi-purpose. There are a lot of things they're going to use for it. And as far as Heinz Field goes, it's one of the more quaint stadiums. It's not quite as big as a lot of the other ones that are out there. And it's catered to Pittsburgh. I mean, you really can't add much onto that anymore, I don't think. Where it's located, you're not going to do a whole lot about parking and traffic. It's just Pittsburgh. You have to deal with that when you're here. putting all of that together, I mean, I'm sure there are going to be things that they'll want to do that they'll come up with, but the structure itself is fine. I wouldn't think there's any particular reason why they'd want a new stadium, and this also isn't a franchise that struggles to bring people in the door. So, you know, I think it's fine for where it is.
Agreed. Neil, always a pleasure. Appreciate it very much.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way. The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back in the final half hour. Phillies will play tonight against Arizona at Chase Field at 9:40. Airtime is set for 9:05 here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Jake Arrieta gets the ball tonight for the Phils. Mike Leake will go for Arizona. Last night, 7 strong innings from Vince Velasquez. And Scott Kingery homered last night, and the Phillies beat Arizona 7-3. So where does everything stand right now? Well, for the Phillies, at this point, it looks like this. The Phillies, trying to keep themselves in the thick of the wild card race, are right now tied with Washington for second place behind the Braves, 6 games back in the division. And the Mets, by the way, are now above 500. So let's see now where the Phillies are in the wild card race, which in the end might be the key to them getting in. But they're 6 games back, tied for second right now with Washington. So when you look at the wild card race in the National League, right now the Phillies and Washington would be tied for the top spot, and the Cardinals are a half game back. So the Cardinals are the outside team right now. The Brewers are 2 back, and the Mets are 2.5 back. Arizona's 3.5 back, along with the Giants at this point. So the Phillies and the Nationals right now are the 2 teams in the wild card spot, and the Phillies will take on the Diamondbacks again tonight at 9:40 with Jake Arrieta on the mound. And Mike Leake goes for the D-backs tonight, and 9:05 will be the airtime with Scott Fransky, LA and company tonight. All right, the Penn State, it's an off day today for the Nittany Lions. He's saying an off day, they just began camp. You have to remember they're still in class, and summer school is going on right now. The last day of summer school will be on Friday. When you're in class, you have to have one off day. So today will be the off day, and then they'll be back at work tomorrow, and tomorrow will be the last acclimation period before they get into full pads. Now, look, they're almost there in full pads. I mean, it's not, but we're talking about, leg pads, knee pads, things like that. And they're almost to that point. They're off to a very good start at this stage. During the course of the season, we're going to have a weekly feature with Pro Football Focus. They are, without question, number one in analytics, whether it's the NFL or college football. Their grading system is, they'll admit, not perfect, but it's outstanding, their grading system, and they're meticulous in their grading system. Cam Miller is the senior writer on the college side for Pro Football Focus. Cam, welcome. It's really great to have you with us.
Appreciate you having me. Always happy to talk college football, but especially some Nittany Lion football.
Absolutely. So let's get to some of the grading out. What influences a grade for a player so we can establish a baseline for the fans and then go through some of the other questions?
So the baseline is every player is graded on every play of every game, FBS level and at the NFL level. It's graded on a scale of a positive or negative, from a negative 2 or to a positive 2, and then every play, it moves the scale in increments of 0.5. So yeah. A strong tackle behind the line of scrimmage within seconds of the snap, is going to move the needle a little bit more than a tackle, 2-3 yards down the field. So a sack, depending on the speed, and a blatant overthrow, just varying levels of different plays on the field all get graded, every player, every game, and it's actually normalized to the scale we see as popularized by our Twitter accounts, our social media, and on our website, and to that 0 to 100 scale.
Now, you had to have a minimum of 250 snaps to get into this. Let's get to some of the Penn State overall grades based on what you saw, and then heading into the 2019 season. You got Micah Parsons in the one spot for Penn State.
We do. We have him at number one. He's a guy who played all over the field last year, as I'm sure all the fans know. Whether that was out of position or not, we'll see where his natural position fits and how well he plays across there. But he's a guy who does everything asked of him and does it all well. Actually, only was tasked with rushing the passer 40 times, but still accumulated 10 pressures on those. So a ridiculous win rate, as we call it, to win 25% of those attempts there when he gets out of the quarterback.
Right, then a guy with a really good length, was not a starter last year, but Tariq Castro Fields.
So, yes, in coverage alone is where he shined You know, maybe what you're saying is true, but you know, looking just directly at his numbers, he's a guy who is maybe even deserving of being in the top conversation or mm-hmm. the conversation for top guys at the position in the conference. So he allowed less than 50% of the targets thrown his way to be complete. He did not allow a touchdown last year, which is pivotal, and then that all equaled a low passer rating when he was targeted of just 56.6. So all of those are up there with the top guys in the conference, and even some of those up there with the guys in the nation.
I think a lot of people, they'll hear Micah Parsons won, they'll go, yeah, because Parsons has the great reputation. But when they say Yetur Gross-Matos at 3, I think there'll be some, quote, Penn State fans that would question that after watching his production last year.
Yeah, so he's a guy, you know, doesn't necessarily get the popularity, but, you know, he's a guy that our draft analyst, Mike Renner, has pegged as, a preseason guy to watch. So that'll be in our preseason draft guide coming out. Details his and everything from his alignment to where he shined and how well he did it on a game-by-game basis. But that's really what we saw. It was just a consistent level of above-average play. So whether that moves the needle for the casual fan, it does for us. That's why he's the third highest on our list here.
Now, fans are not, I don't care what anybody says, you can see what tackles do. But people really can't see what centers and guards do. Oh, I watch every single, yeah, really? Did you watch the ball? Well, yeah, he gained 10. Well, you didn't watch all the blocking. Right? You have Michael Mennett at 4. What goes into what his grade is, and why does he grade it out as well as he does?
So his grade is with run blocking there. So obviously paving the way as a center is going to be a little bit more important as you fan out from the offensive line. He was the plus grades across the board, so pass protection, good grade there as well. But he was shining in what we in our run blocking facet for an offensive lineman. So getting the ball out, but then getting off the line of scrimmage and blowing up the guy in front of him was really where he shined and why he's actually the highest graded offensive player coming back in our qualifying standards.
There's no doubt that Shaka Toney has that first step and can get to the quarterback. I mean, some may question how well in his past he's played the run, but he's played it better and better. You have Shaka at 5 in your Penn State grade list. Why?
So I think his is actually going to be also pass rushing. He's got positive grades both in run defense and then in the pass rush, but that's really where it is. So tasked with rushing the passer only on 185 snaps last year, still recorded over 20 pressures. I just think it, unfortunately for him, pales in comparison to those guys in the rest of the conference, the Chase Young, the Kenny Willickley, the Carter Coughlins of the world, the guys that produce those pass rush triple-doubles that we call. Right. You know, he doesn't quite have those numbers, and that's where I think if he improves, he becomes a household name by the end of the year.
Right. Interesting. So when you get to the Big Ten, Jonathan Taylor, you got him as a 1. What does Pro Football Focus like about him? Because I already know what I don't like about him. That is, he fumbles too much.
That's the one thing dragging his grade down there. So I think if you look at his grades and look at everywhere across the board for a running back, the fumbles are the only thing that drags him down. So we could see if he tightens up the carrying of the ball, so to speak, the pivotal element of a running back, then we're talking about a grade that's upwards of where he's at right now at a 92. But he's a guy who bounces off contact, he breaks tackles, he finds the hole in the zone, takes what the defense gives him, got back-to-back seasons of 1,300 yards after contact alone. So you're talking most running backs don't even get to 1,300 yards total.
Right.
Jonathan Taylor does it all after contact. So
right.
That's what we like about him the most. And if he does shore up these fumble grades, then we're talking about, you know, maybe even one of the better running backs of all time in the conference.
A tackle can be exposed. Cole Van Landen, what makes him such an intriguing prospect?
His is pass protection also. You know, that's where the world of football is going that way. Obviously, Wisconsin a little bit different in how much they do run the ball. But his
yes.
pass protection there, he allowed just 6 pressures on 225 snaps last year. You know, the quick passing attack at Wisconsin obviously aided that a little bit. But he's a guy, a small sample size guy, that we really look to as a potential breakout threat on that offensive line. Obviously, Wisconsin has the documented history of sending guys to the pros, and we just think he's possibly another one of those guys.
Yeah, there is a documented history of them going to the pros. No question about that. All right, so now let's get to the 3 guy here in the conference. And you've already mentioned him, Kenny Willickus, the former walk-on at Michigan State, who has obviously been the guy that makes their defense go.
Yeah, so since 2017, no edge defender returning to college football has more pressures than Kenny does. We're talking 112 pressures. That includes 37 quarterback hits last year, which led the nation by some margin. So while he maybe doesn't get the sacks that every other, you know, what you would expect for a feared pass rusher to get, he's getting to the quarterback more so and more often than anybody else. you know, maybe it's just scheme dependent or the teams that are playing against him know to get the ball out quick, but we're talking 37 quarterback hits is a ridiculous figure that we haven't seen before. So he's just up there. He's another one of those guys that has that pass rush triple-double that we like to call him. So we expect another big year from him.
All right, so now I thought Iowa had a really good defensive line last year, but I thought A.J. Epenesa was the best guy that they had. You have him right here in your top four. What makes him potentially a next-level guy based on the grade that you have for him?
So his length and his pass rush. He's solid against the run. He's able to get his hands up, but it's his pass rushing again. And I feel like a broken record here, but that's really where it is.
Yeah.
Especially today's NFL, so you have to look at the ability to get to the quarterback is going to be pivotal for a guy in his position. So for him to win upwards of 22, even over 22% of his pass rushes on smaller numbers last year than everybody else in the conference, but still put out 10 sacks, 10 hits, 26 hurries, he did all of this production on such a small snap size that if we extrapolate it out, he would actually lead the nation in all of those categories. So that's where we like him to. We like him to kind of have that next step and take that next step to the next level this year.
Okay, a guy that Penn State fans will get a chance to see eventually but have not seen yet is Tyler Johnson, the wideout from Minnesota. He is one of only two, quote, skilled players in your top five, with Jonathan Taylor being the other one. So what makes him stand out?
So Tyler Johnson is must-see TV. He's a guy who does it all at the wide receiver position. Have him pegged as not only the best crunch time receiver in the nation, and that's fourth quarter targets. Got 10 touchdowns on red zone targets as well. Doesn't drop many balls. Can get any pass thrown his way, whether it's a catchable pass or not. Up there in our contested target list. Literally does everything that you would want a wide receiver to do, and he does it well. And so, unfortunately, you'll probably get to see him, Penn State fans, but hopefully, you know, if you limit him a little bit, the Minnesota offense will go as he goes this year.
Yeah, we got Castro Fields here in your top five for Penn State, so it might be a great matchup.
I do. Now we're already looking towards one-on-one battles. I'm excited.
All right. So, Cam, a lot of this is geared. There's a lot of pass rushers in here and so forth. I mean, you've got two potential pass rushers at three potential pass rushers in your top five for Penn State. In the conference, you got two right away there. College football is different than pro football. It's different. Wisconsin runs the ball. Iowa runs the ball. Ohio State runs the ball, right? Michigan runs the ball. Is it difficult to look at a college grade when you have so many teams that still traditionally run the ball as opposed to putting it up like Washington State does 60 to 70 times in a game?
So it's an interesting study and something we're actually looking at as to what correlates from the college level to the pro level in our grading system. And there are a couple of different variables here, but as long as it's an individualized grade, which our grades are,
right,
you really can actually project going forward with what they do and what they do well, and that's where they'll project at the next level. So guys like Epenesa, Chase Young, within these incredible pass rushing grades, long as they stay in a similar role at the next level, that's where they should succeed. So we've seen it with a guy like DeForest Buckner with the 49ers playing out of position from his college position. He had great grades in college, but then they've moved him around the defensive line there, and he has not been able to latch on. Almost same thing actually with Solomon Thomas with the 49ers. So you have guys playing out of position from grades that we've given them at the college level, and that's where we've kind of drilled it down and said, if you play a position in college and play it well, no matter how many times you see it, whether you see Wisconsin run the ball 60 times at you and only maybe 10 passes, as long as you're doing those things well, that's going to correlate to the next level. And that's where I think these pass rushers will hear their names called in April just because of what we've seen so far.
And you would then apply that to a defensive tackle. Their ability to get pressures up the middle, would that allow them to get a higher grade in your mind if they have that ability?
I would think so, for the next level, especially for that projection to the NFL. Unfortunately for the Big Ten, we're kind of lacking in interior defender strong suit this year going forward, but doesn't mean somebody can't break out.
Yeah, what does a quarterback need in your grading system to then become a guy that needs a long, hard look at the next level? What do they need to do?
So what we look at for quarterback projection, there's a couple different things. The PFF grade is actually the number one correlation to the next level. So a guy like Baker Mayfield kind of broke our college grading system, and he's now carried that on. One of the higher rookie grades, if not the highest rookie grade, depending on the snap count limitations or requirements you have. But what we look at outside of the grading system is actually how he fares against pressure and how he doesn't fare against pressure. So clean pocket passing is the most important element, and that's, you know, that's where you see a quarterback make all of his reads and do all of the damage as a pure passer. And so that's where things like passer rating, yards per attempt, when he's kept clean from pressure in the pocket is where that looks forward.
Because the ability that Oklahoma has had the last couple of years to get the ball downfield with Mayfield and Murray. And what Murray, I think, had 10 300-yard passing games last year. Jalen Hurts has had one in his career. How interested are you to see what he does with what Lincoln Riley would like to do?
Well, I'm super interested just because I think a lot of Sooner fans are a little jaded in their belief here. They think that Jalen Hurts is going to be this third transfer quarterback in a row to win a Heisman and lead them to the Big Ten, Big 12 championship.
I think there's a new guy on campus that may unseat him by midseason.
That's all possible. This is a guy at Alabama who yes, Tua Tagovailoa's emergence was, you know, that's be that as it may. Jalen Hurts was being called for to be axed long before that emergence. So you're talking a guy who is a glorified running back. Some people in Alabama were calling him. He does not get the ball down the field very well, and that's documented. An average depth of target, anything over 10 yards, and he was grading negatively almost. So he does have the passing ability, and he does have the rushing ability, but I don't know whether Oklahoma fans are going to be ready for a guy like Hurts at quarterback after having Mayfield Murray.
So. They've been a little spoiled in Norman. A little bit. Tell us a little bit about your preseason draft guide.
So the preseason draft guide, going into it this year, we're looking at everything on, it's up, we're over 100 players. We're looking at their three-year grades, because at this point we've got every grade from any player entering the draft that they've ever taken a snap at the FBS level, some even FCS levels we have. So we're going to look at grades, how many snaps they've played, where they've played it, kind of get a full write-up, upwards of 250, 300 words for each of them. They're also then, it's going to be a comparable. We're going to compare them to the positions in the draft class as well, so how highly the guy ranks compared to his peers, plus minuses. We're going to get some superlatives. It all comes out next week as well, so it's a lot, jam-packed full of information, two full pages, color-coded graphs, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite the project this season that we're really excited to unleash.
But it's a labor of love. You love breaking down numbers and tape, don't you?
It's literally, I live for it. It's what I do.
That's okay. The guy I'm with over here is the same way. And to be honest with you, when I look at the Pro Football Focus grades and so forth, it's a nice guide for me to sit down and watch a tape. I mean, where I sit down, okay, you know, this guy graded out well or didn't grade out well. Let me see why. So it really is a really good tip-off for me as to what I should be watching. When I'm looking at an opponent, no offense to you, Cam, I don't really feel like I need that with Penn State. Okay, it's no offense. But other teams, yeah, I will. I'll take a long, hard look at it.
Yeah, it does, because of the individualized grading portion of it, and obviously we have team grades that jump into there, but the individualized portion really gets you to the point right away. So if you want to look at any team, you can and see which players to watch on any daily basis.
Absolutely. It's become invaluable. Cam, thanks so much. Appreciate your time very much, your analysis very much. Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Happy to be back.
Cam Miller, Pro Football Focus. Every Thursday, we're going to have Cam on the show or somebody else from Pro Football Focus. Mostly, I think it's going to be Cam. But we're going to be talking about the analytics, which then can help you with some of the, quote, matchups as to who is where, what, and why. Not just with Penn State, their opponent, but we're also going to get into some of the matchups nationally and some of the rankings nationally. Cam does a lot of work with their NFL draft, as you could tell, putting those numbers into perspective. So we're going to have somebody from Pro Football Focus on every week on the show as the season progresses, and we're going to take it right into the winter time as well, because obviously Pro Football Focus with the playoffs and then with the draft after that, combines and so forth, we're going to make that a weekly feature. So we appreciate Cam Miller for joining us on the show today. Phillies tonight back in action with Jake Arrieta on the mound against Mike Leake for the Diamondbacks. They look to take game two of this set with Arizona. Last night, the Phillies won 7-3. Vince Velasquez, seven strong innings for the Phillies last night. Scott Kingery homered last night for Philadelphia. And right now, the Phillies are tied with Washington for
the number one wild card spot in the National League. And in the East, they're six games back of the Braves. Phillies and D-backs tonight, 9:40 first pitch, 9:05 the airtime here on News Radio 1070 WKOK.